Good afternoon and welcome to my presentation. I'm going to talk today about storytelling and ethnographic research in a Black storefront church, applications to public health. I only have one thing to disclose. I did write a book last year, and that's what I'm going to be talking about, and I get a small amount of royalties from that book. So the study was community participatory research. Ethnographic data and life histories were collected for 18 months in the Pacific Northwest in a storefront church and the surrounding residential community. The poor and working class African American women who participated in the study ranged in age from 19 to 81. Their educational levels varied from fourth grade to some college. The study took place in 1995, but I want to stress to you that I still know these families very well. And sad to say, little has changed for them or for their children in their health status, their health care, or their economic situations. And I want to stress that because I think we've learned a lot about disparity and discrimination in healthcare since then. And there's a lot of evidence for that in this book and in their stories and in what I observed in the ethnographic piece. And yet, you know, even though we've learned a lot, we really haven't been able to enact a lot of changes in the community that really struggles with issues of discrimination related to race, class, and gender. And I think this is what these stories really tell us, is they show us basically the intersection between that sort of triple type of discrimination that can really create havoc in people's lives. This is really what's termed an ethnography of the particular. And stories and the observations of the everyday can really illuminate the causes of health disparities for us. And they can help tell our stories. I know as public health nurses, every one of you has seen some of what's in this book. Public health nurses, social workers, people who are in, you know, any type of public health tend to really, this book really resonates with them, the stories do, because they've seen this. But what these stories can be used for is, you know, as case studies to showcase our work in many ways and to show people exactly what the situation is kind of on the ground. This type of research is consistent with Black feminist theories because it gives precedence to and respects women's stories and experiences. I want to stress that one cannot generalize from the data, but it can illuminate the effects of larger social policies on the health of families. For example, social policies around incarceration of young Black males. It becomes really clear what the impact might be on a family when their brother is imprisoned or their father is, and for a minor infraction or for too many traffic tickets. So it can illuminate those kind of issues in a community. How can this type of research inform the practice of public health nursing? Well, it can help us to understand more about our communities and the populations we serve. It can strengthen our abilities to build trust and communicate sensitively as we understand more about the communities we serve. It can really help us appreciate the strengths of the people that we serve. It can demonstrate the direct and concrete links between everyday realities and the social determinants of disparities in health. It can help us improve our assessment strategies, and it can inform policy, political action, and social change. The meaning of participatory research is to really involve the community from every single step of the way. And of course, this is really a part of much of the feminist theory as well, and much of the theory that's come out of the people of color movements. I started out with a question around infant mortality. And what I really wanted to do was just ask the women, What do you think about infant mortality in your community? What do you think are the causes? What do you think are the strengths? But it didn't take me very long to realize that I was hitting a major brick wall whenever I asked that question. You know, I started with the question. I asked them, help me decide how to say the questions, you know. And they said, nope, it's your project. You figure it out. And so the women really, but they helped me figure it out because they were very clear about what they would and wouldn't answer sometimes until I got going in the right direction. The women really reframed the question by refusing to acknowledge the underlying premise. They saw the question as racist because it was the way it was framed, and still framed within the blame the victim discourse. To me, it was a neutral question, you know. What about infant mortality in your community? But that wasn't the way that they saw it. They questioned the objectivity of the statistics and the objectivity of the research scientists who generated the statistics. They called on personal experience as something that would, negate some of the statistics. They resituated the question firmly within the context of disparity and inequality and basically everyday life. So rather than focusing on one aspect of health, the women chose to explore health within their lives as poor and working class black women. They led, and I didn't have a choice. I had to follow, and I really, you know, learned a lot from that process. So I changed my interview questions, and I went to just a very broad interview guide adapted from Minister, a feminist frame for the oral history interview. And in that guide, I would say to them, when I met with them, tell the story of your, tell me whatever story you want as if you were writing the story of your life. And they could start at any point and just go wherever with it. And I acted as a witness to that story. These were just sort of random guides questions that I would use if things got quiet or we didn't quite know where to go, which never happened. But I found that, you know, I wanted to say things like, well, what happens when you're feeling good? What happens when you're feeling bad? To find out more about health. Have you ever experienced racism during healthcare? My favorite questions were, who helps you and how do you manage? Because that really gave the women a chance to showcase their strengths. And that was a really important piece of the study. So some examples from what came out of the study in this kind of ethnography of the particular, I'm going to just read you a couple short things in the book. Just kind of looking at environment. This is a map. This is a typical ethnographer's tool. I'm a sociocultural anthropologist. And this is a map of the area where we worked. And the top dark line up there is the Ship Canal Bridge in Seattle. And at one point, that was a sundown zone. Black people weren't allowed across that zone, after sundown. Most of the families still lived in this bottom, more dense part. And that's, shows their homes. It's where most of the hospitals in the cities are. It's where their church is. Some of the younger people have spread out for better housing and better schools into more far-flung communities, but that was the center, and that is still where the families live. I'm going to show you some pictures of the families just to help us realize, who we really are working with, and all those pictures, I've been given permission to use them. This is the church. It's called a storefront church because any church that was formerly used, according to the pastor of the church, any church that was formerly used for another purpose is called a storefront in the black community. This is the pastor. You can see it's a very simple church. I wanted to show you their meeting room downstairs, because it really is a very poor church. There were about 35 members. 8 of them came regularly, and they had a hard time keeping the church afloat. This is a choir made up of 2 members. As I said, it's a very small church. This is a prayer circle in the morning before the service starts. And there are churches like this scattered all over Seattle, as I'm sure there are in just multiple cities all over the United States, where people have migrated north or east or west, and they set up their own church. And all of these people originated in Louisiana and a couple in Georgia. This is a fellowship meeting, and this is how these small churches stayed alive many times, because they met with other small churches, and they raised funds this way. They had music, they shared meals. Now I want to go into some more environmental piece and look at some of the housing issues. And I'm going to talk about two of the participants in particular, Molly and Mabel. This is Molly, and she raised four of her children in the first and oldest Seattle housing project, Yesler Terrace project. And she still lives there. Her mother lives there. And one of her daughters, now grown, lives there as well. And I just want to tell you a little bit about her. She's a child care worker. She gets laid off every summer. She supports sometimes as many as 9 people on her child care worker salaries. When she gets laid off, she has to go apply for unemployment, and about halfway through the summer, she gets about half of what she usually made. But this is what she says about her house. Molly has dreamed of owning an old house with a white picket fence and a big porch where she can sit and rock when she is old. But she now believes that this dream is unlikely to come true. Occasionally, she still says she wants an old-fashioned house if her husband wins the lottery or if she inherits a lot of money. Her mother basically says, "Dream on. You were born in the wrong family." The apartment complex where she lives, she's a long-term resident, and she knows that even if she loses her job, the city will allow her more time to pay. The apartment complex recently underwent exterior renovation, and Molly appreciates the changes. However, she's somewhat frustrated because the residents were not consulted, and there are many problems. Her daughter Roberta's room leaks when it rains, and the workers replace the wooden baseboards with plastic that mice can chew through to come into the home from the basement. The exteriors have been repaired, which she says makes everyone who sees the projects feel good, while the interiors, quote, where we live, are still very depressing. The walls and flooring are stained, the paint is gray, the linoleum is torn, the appliances old, and the furniture sparse, raggedy, and stained beyond cleaning. Molly wants to fix up her home, but tenants are not allowed to paint the units or replace the linoleum themselves. They are told if they do paint or put down linoleum, they must scrape the paint off when they leave and take up the flooring. In the meantime, they're advised to vacuum up any small chips of the flaking old lead-based paint, as it presents a serious health hazard for children. Unfortunately, neither Molly nor her mother, who babysit often, have a vacuum. They can't afford that. Molly routinely spends time on her hands and knees picking up paint chips to safeguard her creeping grandchildren. Her mother, Mahalia, with serious hypertension, is unable to bend over without dizziness, so her paint chips stay where they are, in spite of the presence of children. Then this is another person who I want to describe her housing to you, and this is Mabel Jackson, and she's originally from Louisiana. She has a fourth grade education, however, she does own her own home. And I want to stress that, there was a range of socioeconomic classes in this, which I think is a really important part of this study, because I didn't want to work with only poor people to contribute to the stereotypes that many people have about black people. So there is a range. She does own her own home. However, I'd say she's poor anyway. She lives on her husband's Social Security. Her house is around the corner from the church. It looks tiny from the outside, but is actually quite large inside. It has a shaky fence secured by a rickety iron gate. And then it has a large back lot that goes all the way to the church. A locked iron screen door protects the entry to the house, and the windows are covered with iron bars. The yard is in need of attention. Mabel is in too much pain to care for it herself, and she's too poor to pay to have it mowed and clean. The grass is long and littered with garbage and dog feces. But when you go inside, the living room is cozy, picked up, but crowded and cluttered with overstuffed furniture and tables littered with water glasses and medicine bottles. Photographs of family and friends are everywhere, including one of herself and one of the gospel singer, Mahalia Jackson, who looks a great deal like Mabel did when she was young. Large portraits of Martin Luther King Jr. and John F. Kennedy, as well as religious saints, prominently adorn the walls. The living room is painted a muddy brown, and there are sheets of cobwebs that Mabel cannot reach hanging in the corners, crisscrossing the maze of electrical wires and extension cords strung across the ceiling that ultimately connect to the 2 television sets and 2 portable heaters glowing brightly against the gray February day. Her house is actually a firefighter's nightmare. This is her house. But now I want to go on to say a little bit about policy and, you know, how jobs can really obviously make a huge difference in the type of housing that people can have. This is Joanne Newton. She was another woman in the study, and this is her little boy. None of these names are their names. They're all made up names, which they chose themselves. And this is part of Joanne's family. This is her teenage daughter, who's about 13 at the time, her little boy, and her mother. And this is her home. She and her husband, you know, were probably the most middle class of the group that I worked with. And she herself is a bus driver, and he was a city disposal worker. And these are her sisters. And everyone in this family owns their own home. Everyone in this family is employed, and you know, is better off financially than the other family, the two main families who made up the study. And I just want to take a minute to say something about the children in the study, because I think, as you know, as public health nurses and workers, we're really we are often there because of the children. We're often sent to places and learn about places because of the children. And this is Molly again with her husband Will and her oldest daughter. Her oldest daughter actually had a kidney ailment, and if you get to read the book, you'll see that she experienced some pretty blatant discrimination in the hospital around her kidney surgery. And to this day, she still has that. And as you know, it could flare up if she gets pregnant later or whatever. But so she had a kidney problem. Her mom herself, even though in spite of the fact that they did not want to talk about infant mortality, her mom had, had two miscarriages and two stillborn babies. So they have a history of, maternal and infant problems of the type that we see. But these are her two youngest. She has four children. She has a double set, two older and then two younger. The girls are in college now. They're doing well. And one of them is actually trying to go to nursing school. So, people do hang in there and do, I'm really happy to see this family doing well. Out of the four girls, three of them have done really well, considering, what type of living situation they had and the intergenerational poverty effects. However, their mom worked really hard to get them into good schools and, the good public schools, and they're doing well. This is the other family, and this family, their mom was the youngest, one of the younger members of my study, and she had four children. Well, I guess she was, in her late 20s when we interviewed. Had four children, and today she is actually the director of the whole Northwest branch for the YWCA. So, but two of these children, the two in the middle, the tall girl standing up, and then the little one with the pigtails in the back in the blue coat, are very developmentally delayed, and the other two are fine. And, they had genetic studies done, probably some kind of genetic mismatch between her husband at the time and then her second husband. She did not have those same problems with. But I think that raises the question whenever we talk about genetic things, then you think, okay, well, what happened here? What's go a little bit further than that to think about the genetics. And, did she or her husband get exposed to something? What happened to them that would happen environmentally? She also, was in the same housing project and was raised in the same housing project as the other woman was. These are the grandchildren of Molly, the two little boys, and from her oldest daughter. And they're adorable, full of mischief. The oldest one today has polycystic kidney disease, and he's in his he's still in his teens. The youngest one had with a placenta previa. His mom had to be hospitalized for a long period of time before he was born. He has ADHD, he had hearing problems, and they evolved into some behavior problems. So that prenatal period is really, of course, really important. And both boys, neither one of them has been able to finish high school because things have been really rough for their end of the family. However, they both are employed and, they're doing okay. But they do have long-term health problems. Okay, so looking at health disparities assessment and policy, what you can get out of a study like that is you look at poverty and the associated risks. You look at racism, discriminatory care and health, environment, toxic waste dumps, which was the central district at the time, and demolition of housing projects. They're about to lose the oldest housing project in Seattle to become mixed housing. Lead-based paint and mold in the housing, parents' unemployment status, below the poverty line, child care worker layoffs in the summer. Schools, poor performance of children of color in the Seattle School District, health issues, maybe related to environment, genetics, unexplored variables, criminal justice system, absent fathers, uncles, loss of income. Nutrition, was basically a food desert, a good grocery store was a bus ride away hauling three kids. Food insecurity, poverty, transportation issues. Parental depression due to infant loss of jobs, job stress, poverty, birth of children with health problems, personal health problems, day-to-day racism. So pick your, pick whatever policy you want to work on. They're all there and, can all be addressed. The meaning of moving the rock, I think I have about 1 minute left, and I just want to read to you where I got the title for the book, because it's called Moving the Rock, Poverty and Faith. In a black storefront church, and the reviews are back on the back table, and a way to order the book if you're interested. But the way that I found the title was that I found that it was really hard to combine practice and theory when I was trying to do this study, and it's a very complex effort. And so what I used to get the title that demonstrated the complexity of this effort was a story. A group of Catholic sisters met with a diverse group of women from their community. The panel was scheduled from 9 a.m. until 3:15. The lone black participant said that she did not know much about Catholic sisters and would just listen. She did so until 3 p.m. when she said the following, "Well, I don't know if I can say it too good because I didn't go to school much, but in my heart I know. I'll just tell you a little story. Now, all you nice ladies, imagine that you lived in a house by the road on the top of the mountain, and there's a big rock slide, and a big boulder came right down around the corner of this mountain. And every car that came around that corner hit the boulder and smashed up. Now, I can understand what all you'd do. I heard you. You'd run right out, and you'd take those people out of that car. You'd bandage them up, and you'd bring them in your house and feed them, and you'd pray with them. And when they got well, you'd send them home. Well, sister, what I think you ought to do is send somebody out to move that rock." And so I think that's a good thing for public health nurses to think about, who do that every single day, move the rock for someone. This is the book. Thank you.